Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends, and welcome to the World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At the World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, I'm ready for some amazing stuff. Can we deliver? Is the question every Wednesday. We have our amazing show.
Yeah, this week it's not just amazing. It's the big fat amazing. Okay, so we're taking it up a notch.
This amazing needs to go on a diet. It's so great.
Yeah, that's right, except we don't want it to because it's just fat with amazingness. So, you know, eat amazing. Eat. You're fine. We love you just the way you are.
No one wants a skinny amazing.
That's exactly right. The kids don't want a skinny amazing. We've been doing the amazing here for a few weeks, and I'm telling you, I'm loving Amazing Wednesday. Amazing Wednesday has become my favorite day of the week, and boy, have we got the goods tonight. We got fast trains, we got giant robots, we got the universal translator, and I could have just about said we got the cure for diabetes, but I didn't want to oversell. So I'm not sure if that's entirely fair to say that. So
we may have the cure for the Tower of Babel too. So, you know, but again, we don't want to oversell. So,
well, I did say universal translator. I did say
universal. Oh yeah, that's true. So, yeah. The Babel.
Consider it sold. Yeah. We guarantee that one though. That is an ironclad guarantee from us, and triple your money back if not delayed.
Oh gosh.
But before we do any of that, I just want to give a quick update to our show from last Monday when we talked about, hey, what are we going to do with all the old people? Great story on Yahoo Finance. We're about to see a mind-blowing demographic shift unprecedented in human history. And if you follow that link and read that story, Stephen, do you know what the shift is?
I would expect that it would be more older folks. I mean, that's
for the first time in the history of the world, more old people than little kids. Yeah.
Yeah.
It never been the case before. And that's what we were talking about last Monday, right? I mean, that's basically what we were saying. It's like, well, we got to be nice to the old people because pretty soon we're all them, right? They're going to be the majority.
If we're fortunate, we get to join them. That's right.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. So once again, our predictions of the future backed up a few weeks later by the news. You know, eventually the news catches up with us.
On the cutting edge. Cutting edge.
That's right. If you listen to this show, you're a few weeks ahead of what you're going to, or you know, years ahead of what you're going to see in the news. That's why it's a good reason to listen. But that's all to say. We're going to hear a lot more about this because that gap is going to grow, and the proportion of much older people relative to middle-aged people, right, relative to young adults, relative to little children, the whole thing, right. It's just going to keep swaying. It's going to skew older and older, and it's going to be a very different.
So specifically, according to this article, specifically, just before 2020, and Phil, that's like, you know, right around the bend. I mean, here we are in 2016. That's 4 years away. Just before 2020, adults aged 65 and over will begin to outnumber children under the age of 5 among the global population. So that's not just the United States. And you know, to me, Phil, this is, I see this as good news there's some good news to be said about this. And I would say part of it is this, a mark of a developed nation, of the developing world is, their populations skew older.
Right.
And it could just be a function of the fact that the entire world is is coming along, is developing, that we will begin to see this. And I find it interesting, and I'm going to just call it good news.
I think it's good news. I think it absolutely is. It shows that people are living longer. It shows that population's not growing as fast. I mean, there's so many things you can read into that that data set that are good news. And it's got nothing, and none of that means anything against young people, because we're big fans of the young people on this show. I believe we've mentioned that. I want them off my lawn, but we like them other than that, right? Crazy
That's
loud
right.
music they listen to, but other than, you know, those little things. We're quite
this is an interesting quote. We're arriving at peak youth.
Peak
youth. We've heard about peak oil for years, and apparently here in the next year or two, we're going to be hitting peak youth.
All we're going to do is redefine youth in the same way that we've redefined poverty. You know, in the 21st century in America, poverty includes, you know, living in a home with plumbing and electricity and a nice TV, and you have a car and you have a phone, and, you know, a lot of things that poverty did not, you know, you have food to eat, and, you know, a lot of things poverty didn't used to entail. And the same way we're gonna redefine youth, and, you know, did I mention my idea last year that maybe you just don't let anybody even vote until they turn 80? They'll be too young, right? Youth will be 80 and under.
You need some life experience, you know.
That's right. Youth will be 80 and under, and then once you get into your 80s, you can start.
We kind of have an interesting history about that in the United States. The voting age was 21 until the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War, basically, you know, the younger people said, "Hey, if we're going to be fighting and dying, we need the vote."
Right.
And it was the voting age in the United States was dropped to 18 after that. So.
Yep, they did it all wrong. What they should have done was raise the voting age to 25 and the draft age.
There you go. You can't be drafted until your voting age.
That would have really changed the dynamics of that, I can tell you. But, hey, we digress, and we got too much amazing stuff to talk about to get into history. Anyway, peak youth coming, who's that old person looking at you in the mirror? That's going to be you, folks, so look forward to that. All right, so let's move on. How about this, Stephen? Megabots raises $2.4 million to create a league of human-piloted giant fighting robots.
Hey, I'm all about this.
The future has arrived, okay? What's not to like about this story? What I love about this is it's understood that there is tremendous commercial potential for this, right? And you know why there is. I mean, you know why there is. It's because there's such a huge following for manga. There's such a huge following for anime. And there's such a huge following for, like, monster truck shows, right? And here you combine the best of those.
All
things.
Of that. Yeah.
Yeah, tractor pulls and monster truck shows and demolition derbies. And take all of it up a notch, right, or two, because you get to go into a place and actually see two huge robots fight it out, not really literally to the death, but that's going to be that is going to be pretty awesome. I can't tell you how much I look forward to taking my son to see this.
It'll be a lot of fun. But I'm going to tell you, the entertainment value of it is one thing. But I see these things as performing useful work. Number one, it seems obvious that this could easily be militarized. I mean, a platform up high like that where you could see the battlefield. And then be able to fire from up there while being relatively safe. I could see these things contributing a lot to whatever side they're fighting on. We all remember the load lifters from Aliens, right?
Right, right.
That Ripley got in and fought the alien queen with. Well, I mean, useful work to just, haul boxes around or whatever. Could you imagine a big enough load lifter just picking up shipping containers off of a vessel and go load it on a train? We're doing that already with cranes, but there might be a need for the ability to move something quickly like that from one place to another.
Well, what you've got there is you've got an all-terrain forklift that can grasp things differently than a forklift is restrained.
Right.
Right. I mean,
right.
So it's an all-terrain forklift that combines the best features of a crane. So I agree. Yeah. I mean, there are all kinds of potential.
It's on tracks like a bulldozer or something, and you know that's how it moves. It's not walking with legs just yet, but
yeah. But still, you can run it, you know, on a lot of surfaces you wouldn't be able to run a normal forklift on, right? I mean, it's,
right.
Yeah.
I can just see this thing. Yeah. Again, it'll be a lot of fun to see these things fighting, but. I think that it won't be long that we see these things on the battlefield and loading and unloading things at the local docks, you know. So
it'll be interesting though if that's the case, if it ends up being a technology that is ultimately exploited for, you know, logistics and shipping and some of those kind of construction, potentially some of those kinds of businesses, and also for military applications. It'll be interesting that it got its start in entertainment. That doesn't usually happen, right? It's usually the other way around that those things happen. Because these guys are funding it because they want to build them, because they want to put on shows with these things. But once the technology exists, I think you're right, Stephen. I think the applications will start to present themselves, and people will start looking for machines that can do these things. And
yeah.
It probably won't be too long before they do have legs. I think that ultimately Pacific Rim is a documentary. That's what I believe.
I remember back. It was not long after 9/11, and you know we were gearing up for war, and I think it was somebody half jokingly, wrote a column about what we really need to do is build a Gundam mecha. You know, just the shock and awe of it. You know, just enter the battlefield, just, you know, with one of those 60-foot-tall robots just to, you know, show we mean business. they said, you know, and they did some, you know, back-of-the-envelope calculations for that column, and I think it came to about $1 billion that it would take to build one. I think that you could do one cheaper than that now. And
yeah,
2.4
well,
million
is
what they're talking about. With a much smaller mecha here, obviously.
Yeah,
But
the point is, once you start making them, it gets cheaper to make them.
That's
sure.
Right. You get the first one's always going to be the expensive one.
Prototypes,
that's your proof of concept, and then after that, you put them on the assembly line. And get
once you've got something like an assembly line cranking these things out, what an awesome idea that is! you know, so that everybody can have one, right? I can think of a few things around the house that I could definitely use one of these for. you know,
and your commute would be so much more interesting too, Phil. I mean, you know, come on.
Well, I work in my basement, so just have him set me down here every morning, I guess. but anyway, I think it's very cool. The pictures alone to me of the robots make the whole story worthwhile. I think it's awesome that they've raised the money. I think they will be tremendously commercially successful with it. And again, it's kind of like other stories we've talked about. If not this instance of it, somebody's going to do this right and make a lot of money off this. And I think you summed it up brilliantly, Stephen, that it won't stop there. That once big robots like this exist, they're going to have all kinds of applications. And we've not heard the last of big robots. We're going to be hearing a lot more about them. Let's move on because we've got some other totally amazing stuff to talk about. And I don't guess there's anything much more amazing than Elon Musk's Hyperloop concept, his idea of a high-speed maglev, essentially vacuum tunnel train from San Francisco to L.A. that would get you there in about 30 minutes, right? I was surprised that I remember reading about this. You know, this was the one project that Musk did not personally have time for. He was like, I'm sorry, I'm redefining the car, I'm going to Mars, so he wrote this.
Lazy jerk.
I know, jeez. Well,
get
know,
off
some
your
people,
butt, man.
Some people go the extra mile, and then there's Elon Musk, okay, that's all I'm saying. But he wrote this treatise, right? I mean,
right.
You know, in his spare time, right, for fun, he writes up this, here's how this thing ought to work.
Yeah.
And there are two companies now working on trying to make this happen, one of which did their first test last week. And Stephen,
it was amazing too, Phil. I mean, it was a half mile long track, and the thing got up above 100 miles an hour in half a mile. You know, and of course, in order to get it to stop in time, they had all the sand out there to get it to stop. That thing shot out I can imagine being on that thing, how many G's you would have been pushing in the acceleration. I suspect that the ultimate, for passengers, it will be, they'll accelerate a little slower than that, because, I mean, that thing shot out of there like it was coming out of a cannon. You know, I wonder, Phil, is this in some ways related to railgun technology? The railgun works by magnets too, right? It's shooting out a projectile by way of magnets, correct?
Yeah, the difference I think here would be that with a railgun, the magnet is part of the propulsion of the projectile. In these maglev trains, I believe they're just lifting the train using the magnets, and they're pushing it along using just very conventional means. One of the reasons that
I'm not sure. I think you might be wrong about that.
I could be wrong. But one of the things I've read about this is that one of the reasons that it works, one of the reasons that companies are putting money into it, is that every part of it already exists. You don't have to develop any new technology.
The science is there.
Yeah.
And one of the cool things is you're going to be going faster than the speed of sound, but you're not going to be breaking the sound barrier because it's a near vacuum, you know. And so, don't have to worry about sonic booms or anything, but you are going faster than the speed of sound.
Right.
When they get that thing humming along at full speed. That's amazing, Phil. I read about a service today that will drive people. They call it the night bus or whatever, that you have a little sleep pod. It's like one of those Japanese casket hotels. You know what I'm talking about? But it's in a bus, and so it'll take you from San Francisco to Los Angeles for that 6-hour drive, and then wake you up when you arrive. And they do that, and you know they have it going. Apparently, they got it going every night. You know, one time to the next, so you don't have to worry about the commute. You just wake up where you need to be. I think that's pretty cool, but hey, getting there in 30 minutes is even better. So,
well, yeah, the concept of this overnight bus, it's really a truck between San Francisco and LA. I mean, it goes to show there's a lot of different ways to skin the cat, I suppose. Sleeping is also a way of, you know, kind of making good use of time and essentially, taking care of business. And it's one night that you didn't have to spend, on an expensive hotel in either LA or San Francisco, because you're going to be laying out some cash for this thing. It only cost $60 or $80 or something like that to take the trip. So it's, as a hotel room, it would be a pretty good deal. Plus it gets you to the other city. One of the things I was thinking, and I was reading through this, Stephen, you're right, it looks to me like both of these are actually using the magnets to push the thing along, so I guess it is closer to the railgun than I was thinking. The real thing to do with this would be not to have a line connecting San Francisco and L.A., have a line going due east, right, from both of those cities, out into the middle of nowhere, right, and you could build cities there with really inexpensive real estate, and people to be able to live there and take these 30-minute train rides into the
straight out into the desert. Here you can live in this beautiful wide open spaces, and in 30 minutes you can be at the office in downtown Los Angeles.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of traffic between the two. I've been on that flight, actually, one of those flights, many times from LA to San Francisco and back. So there's trains, planes, and automobiles connecting people between the two, because there's an awful lot going on. And doing it in 30 minutes would be pretty appealing. I think that would be a pretty wonderful thing. But the whole nightmare of commuting if you live in the Bay Area, and people go farther and farther east trying to find affordable housing. You know, so there's
right.
There's the East Bay, and then there's way outside of the East Bay, and you're just out in flyover country, and you know, there's still just suburbs as far as the eye can see, and it's still really expensive, and it takes forever to get into the city from out there. This might actually, you know, a solution like
it's
this
kinda,
could really help alleviate.
Telecommuting has become a huge deal for people out there. I mean, and as well as and yourself, Phil. But I mean, part of it is just to live in an affordable house and be able to work where the action is. It's just huge long commutes to the point that it's just not practical anymore. And that's why a lot of people might telecommute 4 days out of the week and go into the office just when they have to. You know,
right?
But this would create the opportunity for people to have affordable housing and be able to come in every day if they need to. That's cool.
Now let me ask you something, Steve. Would you ride on this thing? Does it sound kind of scary to you, traveling through this vacuum tube at 300 miles an hour? Does it seem kind of, I don't know.
Well, if you just explain the concept of a commercial airliner to somebody 100 years ago.
True.
It's cool. You'll like it. We're going to take you up to 30,000 feet, and we're going to cruise along about 300 miles an hour. And
somebody who's never been 20 feet off the ground. Yeah,
That's right. And
somebody who's never gone 10
and,
miles
and never
an hour,
gone any faster than a horse could gallop.
Yeah,
That's yes. In answer to your question, I would do it, and I would want to see a safety record and see how much it's been tested and everything else. But yeah, I would definitely get on it.
I would.
I think.
I could
see doing it.
And ultimately, obviously, the technology can be applied. If you can have a route connecting L.A. and San Francisco in 30 minutes, you can have a route connecting L.A. and New York in whatever that would be, a couple hours, 3 hours, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
I could see Los Angeles to Las Vegas. That would happen pretty quick. And then
you would think,
Las Vegas to Denver would happen pretty quick.
Yep.
Well,
because you could have your route across the country. You know, it's like Denver is one of those cities that gets to be a hub when those kinds of things get set up. Because, you have a Chicago to New York. I mean, you look at the most traveled airline routes, and those would be good routes for this, too, right? And
oh, yeah,
you look at
absolutely.
The most traveled
Denver would be a hub for this. Atlanta would be a hub for this.
Exactly.
Dallas would be a hub. So, you're exactly right. You just have to show that it's working and it's profitable in this one place, and then they could crunch the numbers and figure out how to do it for other places too. So more power to these guys. I'm excited about it.
Absolutely. I can't wait to see these trains coming online. All right. Well, we got two more amazing things, and we're running desperately low on time here, so we better push on. We've only got time for one more topic, but we got to get them both in. So let's do it. Diabetic stem cells were just transformed into insulin-producing cells. This is awesome.
Just awesome news. Just awesome news. These are type 1 diabetics. So these are people that were born without the ability to produce insulin in their body. And the thought was, Phil, that these researchers are saying, you know what, we could have it working in a test tube and inject it into these people, but they've got something wrong with them that it wouldn't work in their body. Well, it turns out not to be the case, at least in mice. These type 1 diabetic mice, you take their stem cells, you create stem cells that produce the insulin, you put it into them, and it works just fine. Their body is not fighting, it's apparently the defect is in the making of the pancreas, not in the accepting of the cells that make the insulin. So, they were pleasantly surprised, the researchers were, that this seems to be working, and they're ready for human trials real quick, in the next couple of years. So, excited.
Very encouraging.
This.
I mean, it's not the cure to type 1 diabetes, but, I mean, come on, this is closing in on a cure to type 1 diabetes, isn't it? I mean, this is the direction you want to be going with that, for sure.
That's right. Reminded of that joke on the Big Bang Theory, why else would you create a pancreas in a gibbon? You may not get the reference, Phil, but anyway, this is obviously a big mile marker on the way to curing diabetes, and that's awesome.
Yeah, so keep it up. Let's move that along. I think that's fantastic, and you know, it's just cool that they're doing it at the stem cell level to produce actual, you know, beneficial cells in the in the hosts. Just you know, keep that methodology going and see where it takes us. Okay, finally, we buzzed through that one, so this leaves us a little bit of time to talk about Meet the Pilot Smart Earpiece Language Translator. So I confess I haven't had a chance to really read this story to any depth at all. I've just kind of glanced at it. But am I hearing what I think I'm hearing? Is this the universal translator? It hears in one language and it reads it into your language to you so that you can talk back to the other person in your language and they'll hear it in their language? Is that right?
That's exactly it. That is exactly it. This is a project on Indiegogo. We have no inside knowledge on how well this works, but their video is impressive. It shows someone without any training at all, just putting the earpiece in their ear. It's a pretty French girl he wants to talk to, right? So he hands her this and says, you know, just, you just kind of, you know, put it in your ear, and he speaks to her, and immediately, she can hear it in French, and then she responds in French, and he hears it in his earpiece in English. And, pretty soon they're getting coffee and hitting it off, right? So, that's incredible. And not just for, you know, hitting it off with a pretty French girl, but the business that this could, you know, that, you know, the barriers that this brings down to allow people to conduct business throughout the world. I'm excited about this. Hope that this is this works as well as advertised in that video. And if not, I think it's only a matter of time. It seems like we've seen products moving in this direction for a while. And the fact that now that it's small enough, it can fit. It looks like a hearing aid is what it looks like. And inside the ear hearing aid. So it's pretty amazing.
Well, you know what I like about this is it's a reasonable next step after the kind of written version of this, which has been going on for a while now with things like Google Translate, where people can write in their own language, have it translated over the other language, the person reads in that, and they write back. And we know that things break down in there. And things are almost certain to break down here, too, to some extent.
Right.
But it's getting better. I mean, Google Translate's getting better, better and better. It's learning as it goes. It's, you know, it's training itself. Once again, it's one of those models that's training itself as it goes. And this thing, I think, will probably, because it's going to have that live, dynamic, real-time thing happening, I think it will probably, once it's widely deployed, really drive not only language translation, but just natural language processing along in a huge way. I think that natural language processing is going to get a huge boost from this. And we were talking recently about the conversational user interface. This will probably be one of the things that really helps make that happen, because computers are really going to understand human language to be able to pull something like this off in real time.
Yeah, why couldn't this, as a, like a side benefit, take your dictation and send texts and emails? I mean, that to me, that he wouldn't even have to add anything to it. I mean, just a little bit of just add an app. It could be, this thing could be a platform for apps. You can have its own app store for this thing.
Absolutely.
So I think it's cool, and I'm not ready to invest in the Indiegogo project, but I'm excited that this is potentially happening, and barriers coming down. It's awesome.
Pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. That's the word you're looking for, Stephen.
Yeah, there we go.
That's what we're
amazing
all about.
And
well,
more
that
amazing.
That does it for another amazing Wednesday. Thank you all for being with us. We're going to be back on Friday with one more all-new show for this week. And until next time, live to see it.